Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Grassroots Marketing continues now on CannabisRadio.com. And right now, I'm bringing on a returning guest who was on our Blunt Business program just recently. And we had talked to him and his colleague, Kevin Williams, the attorneys at Clark Hill. And we talked about the reclassification of cannabis and the implications for industry trade and industry-wide. So you can look at that episode dated January 2 and 12th over on Blunt Business. But for Grassroots Marketing, we're going to take another story important to go and give heads up from the Clark Hill website. And at clarkhill.com under news and events, you can find the blog post on the intersection between marijuana and the Second Amendment, what gun owners need to know. Just to summarize on this really quickly, it's about the legal conflict between federal and state cannabis laws and where it impacts gun owners, because now federal law, where it classifies cannabis as Schedule 1, was prohibiting gun ownership for users. But now in states where cannabis is legal, federal law still applies. So now we're in a conundrum where gun owners who use cannabis for medical or adult use purposes, there's an issue regarding the change from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. So I'm here with Craig Small, the other colleague from Clark Hill, who's going to speak about that. What is the distinction that gun owners need to understand as to what the rescheduling has changed now that the Schedule 3 is going to be put into play?
Well, thank you, Brostone. Thank you for having me back. I certainly appreciate your show and all the hard work you put into it.
Thank you. So
what kind of attracted me to this subject is Second Amendment rights certainly are a hot topic issue in the United States. I would like to say today, but it seems like it has been for all time. But certainly as cannabis users are moving forward their lives, as approximately 70% of the U.S. is a cannabis user at some point or another, it becomes more important to understand how cannabis use can affect other areas of your life that you may not realize are affected. And so as a firearm owner myself, and I'm the rare cannabis attorney who actually doesn't use cannabis, it doesn't actually affect me personally. But as friends with many cannabis users and firearm users, certainly I want your audience to know that by having a firearm, you are technically in violation of federal law of having a firearm while also being an unlawful user of a controlled one substance under federal law. And that could have drastic consequences on your federal rights, certainly a fine, certainly prison time. So it's something I want users to be aware of. Where this kind of is moving forward is the monumental change with the DEA notice to proposed rulemaking session to change marijuana from a Schedule 1 substance to a Schedule 3 substance. And there's certainly a lot of discussion to be had around that. But for purposes of this podcast, by changing it to a Schedule 3, you're now bringing marijuana into a federal legalization system. Certainly not quite the system that we're seeing in place today. I don't know what that system's going to look like. But now, once it's labeled as a Schedule 3 drug, it can be lawfully used and therefore cannot be grounds for denying cannabis users the right to bear arms.
So this is the thing where when we talked about Schedule 3 of cannabis, the rescheduling, and how it would affect where the DEA would have further oversight, much like the FDA has with the hemp bill. So now you have a three-letter agency that's going to be handling that. In the case of gun owners, the ATF, alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and explosives, now they're going to be policing even more closely those who, first of all, they're going to be looking more closely at federally licensed firearm dealers from selling firearms or ammunition to anyone who they know is a cannabis user. That's from the Marijuana Policy Project. They make that point across as well. But if we're looking at what the legislators have been worried about when it comes to the Second Amendment, they're always worried about the gun control, about what types of weapons citizens can have. So they're always been worried about assault rifles, hunting rifles, and maybe even limiting the amount of handguns that are allowed. But what is it? I mean, do you feel like that there's been any kind of push around about that? Because, okay, in one of the cases from MPP, they make the point of that the Republican from Alaska, who's very much moderate, Lisa Murkowski, that when legalization of cannabis was done adult use in the state, voters passed it. It was an amendment. And then she became an advocate for protecting Second Amendment rights for constituents who choose to use it. And also, you know, advocates were urging the NRA, National Rifle Association, and other Second Amendment advocacy organizations to defend the consumer rights of cannabis users. So we've seen only, you know, publicly about the gun control issues in that respect, but they never really talk about the gun control issues for those that might be, you know, mentally incapacitated or feel like if they're under the influence of alcohol or tobacco, or if they think cannabis is something that's influential, that in that same respect, they really haven't talked much about that, or anyone that has any kind of a medical history of mental illness, those kind of things, where there's any kind of a, you know, psychological or just any kind of neurological differences. That hasn't been the part that's ever been focused on, but is that something you're seeing that might be focused on more now?
You're actually hitting it right on the head. That's where the discussion should be going, is not so much per se rights to take away firearms or per se rights to keep firearms. There's a larger issue at stake here, and that is mental health. Certainly a larger topic than I really am ready to speak on today, but the cases on cannabis and Second Amendment rights that intersect start highlighting these areas that need to be discussed. And that's where the case I cite in my article, I got so many cases in my head. Let me just go to it to make sure I cite it correctly. But United States District Court for the Western District of Oklahoma, mm-hmm. That is the Jared Williamson case, I believe.
Right, February 3rd, the U.S. District Court, Western District of Columbia, it was dismissing criminal charges against defendant Jared Michael Harrison on grounds federal law prohibited his ownership of firearms in connection with lawful state use of cannabis, unconstitutional restriction of his Second Amendment rights. So exactly. But that's a case that's gone in a district court, but, you know, is that case going to be something now that, since it was dismissed, so we're not going to deal with anything where the Supreme Court will have some kind of talk about this. Nothing has to be escalated at the district court level. It was dismissed. So Second Amendment rights stayed in favor for that person, regardless of his cannabis use.
Right. It was dismissed, but actually the federal government filed an appeal. That appeal was abated pending another U.S. Supreme Court case that was cited just last month, U.S. versus Rahimi. And U.S. versus Rahimi even goes more to the point we're talking about, although not in the context of cannabis. But in U.S. versus Rahimi, Rahimi was a subject of a civil protection order with domestic violence implications. And so there, the question was, can his Second Amendment rights be taken away? Can his firearms be taken away pending the results of a civil protection order? In that case, the Supreme Court issued its ruling saying, yes, it can, because going back to the Second Amendment rights, it's not a per se category of if you're this or if you're not that. It goes back to, are you fundamentally a person who is has a crime of violence or actual use or threat of violence? What type of individual are you that would require a firearm to be taken away? And to kind of circle this back to the mental health aspect of this, that's where it needs to go, is a better understanding of mental health of individuals. And analysis of individuals and determination of the science of mental health to determine whether individuals are likely to pose a threat to others. And if so, then the firearm should be taken. But that's not the current state of the law.
But in the current, right now, what you said in the article, that Oklahoma is not the only state that's dealt with challenging cannabis consumers' rights to own firearms. It's also being argued or have been decided in Florida, Texas, or elsewhere. So one of these cases, I mean, do you see it where it could be escalated and appealed to the Supreme Court? Do you think we'll get to that point where one of these cases will have to be determined by the Supreme Court?
Well, with the rescheduling to, from 1 to 3 by the DEA, that may not be necessary because it takes away a lot of the arguments that the ATF uses in their memo. When you go to purchase a firearm, before they issue that firearm to you, you have to do a national a NICS test. And I'm sorry for referencing my notes so much. Like I said,
I got a lot going on in my head.
No, you're fine. You're fine.
So,
but the other thing I got to make of is this. All right. So on the court end, we can see if something's going to happen where, you know, there might be a case that gets brought up, and if it has to go and lead up to the highest court in the land to determine, because of all these cases, one of them might rise to that level. We have to wait and see about that. Stay tuned. We have more Blunt Business coming up after a short break.
Rolling into some sponsors, but we'll be right back with more Blunt Business.
Welcome back to Blunt Business. I'm here with Craig Small. The other part is on the legislative end. So we have to see where the political discourse plays out now with the upcoming presidential election and also general election for Senate and House seats for half of those that are serving in office right now. Because of the way that the current climate is right now, you know, there's a lot of changes. Obviously, we're doing this recording as the day after President Joe Biden has determined to no longer to withdraw himself from the presidential election, but will continue to serve as president through the rest of his term. But with that said, we know we are not aware of who will be the Democratic candidate that has not been put in stone. And no matter what the election does, if there is a down ticket effect where we get some kind of a supermajority, but not a filibuster proof majority of House and Senate, I think at one point we'll get to a point where we're supermajority will get us to a point where laws that could be introduced might actually be brought up to be voted on. So like for Alex Mooney, the representative from West Virginia, who introduced a bill to explicitly prevent the sale, purchase, and possession of firearms to users of medical marijuana. Something like that could be brought up, or federal legalization that could address all of these issues. But until then, you know, all we're doing is, it's a lot of speculating right now. We just need to be aware of it. Is there anything where you feel like, do you feel like it's a timetable that people need to be worried about that the Second Amendment rights for those that are cannabis users could be compromised? Is there anything that you all that could be an immediate issue right now?
Not right now. Certainly the current trend of the law is favoring cannabis users and possessing firearms. If there's a change in administration and a new administration decides to throw out everything the prior administration has pushed forward, all we get back to is status quo. Then that new administration would have to push forward their own legislation, of which, given this area of partisan politics, I don't know how anything will get done.
But it's all locked up. There's nothing much going to be pushed around anyway. So I'm not, plus on top of that, the way they handle, you know, they put out bills, you have omnibus bills that are just loaded with so much that's going on underneath the actual bill itself. No separate bills being passed. That's why nothing's going to get done. But I got to ask about this now. Because of the rescheduling of cannabis, we know that there's going to be more research being done from the medical front. And I would like to just make a point of to this audience out there, for any of those researchers right now that are looking for the fact of, okay, now we have more product to work with for research purposes. We can get more research done now because we have the guys and, you know, the approval from the DEA where more research can be done because of the rescheduling. I would love to see some research being done by whichever university, academic institution, researcher, whoever it is. I'd love to see a white paper. I'd love to see something that shows what is the effect of cannabis use on someone that handles heavy machinery, handles a firearm, or what have you. I'd like to be able to see research that gives us that kind of input to counteract any kind of argument from a legislative or courtroom level. What do you say?
I agree 100% with you. And certainly there's already a large body of scientific medical knowledge on cannabis and its effect on the human body. I would like to see research on cannabis and aggression. I like to see cannabis and impulse control. I'd like to see maybe reverse engineer it and look at people who are committing firearms violence and see what common characteristics those people have, and then do a cannabis study against those common characteristics to see if there's any overlap.
I'll give you these test examples. Veterans. Give me somebody from the military who's well-versed and well-skilled in handling firearms, using them in various different climates and various different environments. And I guarantee you, a lot of the military, you know, maybe they might not have had medical marijuana at the time, or they might have found a way to get themselves access to various, you know, drugs, whatever they might be, when they were out overseas or they were, you know, on duty, they were being assigned. I can see where some of that comes up. And if they could just show like their past use and show there are no significant effects, there's no entourage effect or anything like that, that dissuades anyone from being able to use a firearm effectively and, you know, carefully, you know, they can use it properly, you know, under the rights of what they are given in the Second Amendment. They're using it for self-defense. They're using it for, you know, various recreational purposes and nothing more.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be an interesting study, because certainly there's a long history of marijuana use in the military, both for currently serving armed forces and veterans. So, that certainly would be a great macro study and a long-term study to track people as they go through their military career and post-military career on their use of marijuana and any instances of violence that may surround them that they may be a part of.
I would love to see that. I think that will be extremely important for what we're doing here. It, just to go ahead and bring the awareness out to the community that we need to go ahead and see something like this happen where, all right, now we have the opportunities that what this rescheduling is going to give us. So now we know that some more opening. Again, the government has just, they have recognized cannabis. They recognize that there's not the kind of damage or narrative that we've been hearing for years. They're accepting that. We had how many different researchers and scholars that actually, upon the rescheduling, to recommend the rescheduling from the Health and Human Services, they received themselves. All these three-letter agencies are proving our point. And so even the fact that on the ATF, now they can scale back a bit on their control and their oversight over cannabis changes as well. So like, let's, as the cannabis industry itself, take advantage of these opportunities from the research end, from be able to go ahead and let it where, you know, there's ways to do it. I want to just recommend this. I want to highly implore that the academic institutions around there that are going to be doing work on cannabis use, take a look at this, because this is very important. And I'll tell you, if you are advocating for the fact that Second Amendment users, gun owners themselves, they can be allowed to be cannabis users, that only helps the industry itself. Be an advocate for veterans, because we can also talk about the fact that, you know, with no underlying effects for using firearms, you're also talking about the veterans that have dealt with PTSD or various other psychological, mental, physical issues that they're dealing with right now that we're going to show with research, and with the possibility of cannabis being rescheduled, there's going to be more possibilities to show the benefits of cannabis than there are detriments.
That's very true. And you can actually approach this issue from both sides. So certainly, we want to see the data.
Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay Green 1-cubic-foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
We want to see the scientific research. You know, we want the foundational knowledge to make smart decisions when it comes to firearm use and who can bear arms. At the same time, cannabis consumers should also take this into their hands and make sure that if you are going to possess a firearm, take proper safety classes, understand how to use your firearm, keep it in a safe place. You know, the last thing that the cannabis industry wants is a PR of someone who was a cannabis user, does have a firearm, and some accident happens, and then that's just going to be the poster child for why cannabis users should not possess firearms. But it's all easily avoidable. To everyone who has firearms, should always be taking classes on how to use them safely.
I think it was a very good subject to bring up on board. And we are so far ahead of the subject anyway, but it's important to go and note that we should have this discussion here, and this should be out in the ether right now for our audience to hear this out, because you need to be aware of this can be something that's also an implication that people just need to know, and we need to be proactive on as an industry as well. Just like everything else I thought about being proactive when it comes to compliance, when it comes to various issues of curbing the illicit market. I mean, look, there's a part where, you know, there are various other drugs out there that can impair anybody from using a handgun or from driving or for whatever they're doing that is much worse that we know of right now. And you know, that's not being curbed. And for cannabis, it is regulated and controlled. The industry doesn't need to be punished or penalized for that. And I think the government, federal government right now, is starting to look at that. The state governments obviously see that with more and more states green lighting adult use every day. Right now, where I'm at in Florida, I'm waiting for it to come through with an amendment. Amendment 3 right now looks like it should be an end for Florida to be able to get adult use. So be another one of those states to bring it over 40 states right now with medical, and what, some odd 30 states right now with adult use or getting close to that if we haven't gotten there already. So I'm all waiting for it. But proactivism right now is key, and staying ahead and being the tip of the spear when it comes to these kind of issues. Again, Craig Small, attorney with Clark Hill. Website is clarkhill.com, C-L-A-R-K-H-I-L-L.com. Anything you want to tell us real quickly about the practices and what they should do in terms of staying on top of the situation?
Well, I mean, certainly if you can follow Clark Hill, follow myself, we have a fairly large cannabis industry group that's always looking at these issues and publishing content on that. You can also find me on LinkedIn, always looking to find more content and then just inform the public. This is an industry that has been asking for regulation since its inception and is mostly self-regulated from a grassroots up. So certainly all your listeners, they are part of, they are the grassroots. And so any impetus of any change in this industry is going to come from the individuals listening to this show.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Craig. Really appreciate it. Thanks for taking time out.
Thank you, sir.
Stay tuned. We have more Blunt Business coming up after a short break.
Rolling into some sponsors, but we'll be right back with more Blunt Business.
Welcome back to Blunt Business. Right now, I want to go ahead and play for you an interview that I had with Todd Pomiak with Saks LLP. He had me featured on his Good Morning Cannabis program, and I would like to go ahead and play that back and let you hear my take on the state of the cannabis industry. Take a listen.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself before I ask the all-important questions that I normally ask my audience?
People might have heard my voice because I host Blunt Business and the Grassroots Marketing Series on CannabisRadio.com. Been doing Cannabis Radio, working in the programming for 9 years now, 10 technically, but it's been since 2015. June, we started the network, and we've been servicing all things cannabis, everything from the enthusiast side, the advocacy side, legalization, and medical. That's where we've all encompassed about, because that's what encompasses the cannabis industry itself. And that's what we've been covering ever since, chronicling what's been going along.
So you're basically a cannabis media OG.
I think, well, pretty much when we saw Prop 64 come to light and to fruition, and legalization in Colorado, California, well, I mean, it was something that, you know, the management was always looking into, was cannabis somewhere to go in terms of another sector to go into? Because in our background, we've worked in fringe sectors. We worked in technology, and we worked in other areas that, you know, we felt that it was needed to be serviced, and that was the areas we wanted to look into. Cannabis always was just something that was in our purview. And when we started seeing things open up, that's what happened. Even right now, in the last year, psychedelics have started to open up in the country, and we're also incorporating psychedelics programming on the network as well.
That's awesome. So you actually had me on your show, I think it was about a month or so ago, and thank you for that. And I wanted to have you speak a little bit about your knowledge as a cannabis media OG. What, in your line, are the top three issues that the industry is facing? And what would you say would make the industry better addressing those issues? And you could do it alphabetically, you can do it numerically, whatever you want to try.
Well, when I look at the areas that people are worrying about when it comes to the industry, first of all, is trying to keep business above ground because inflation, the economy, economic conditions right now, what investments are available right now. because people were just, you know, it's the growth trajectory that companies want to have. Meanwhile, there's only so much can be done because we're waiting for legalization. And everybody's trying to go and time out their timeline as to when legalization is going to come. They think it's going to be next year. They think they'll get safe banking or other things that will come in. So far, the industry's gotten a carrot from the current presidential administration with rescheduling. Other than that, I don't see legalization coming for another 3 to 5 years. You have to wait for a supermajority in Congress for something to happen. Other parts is to look at what each market that's being greenlit for medical or adult use. And when it comes to adult use, you want to keep an eye on the fact that what's being done for the craft cannabis owners, the smaller owners. The MSOs are going to make their way through. They're going to succeed and thrive. But when you have social equity programs that are all different varieties, whether it's a lottery system or it's just finding qualifications, and some other things that are being done where all these cannabis control boards, they're not paying attention to the fact that you have no way of who's going to get those licenses and who's going to be able to obtain those. And, you know, how many of those companies that are trying to come on up don't have the resources, the financial acumen, or, you know, the know-how or the people around them to be able to go ahead and move forward? And the other part is compliance. I think where if you want to go ahead and legitimize the industry, you know, we have a lot of talk about how there's good housekeeping practices. For CBD, there's the Cosmetics Act of 1920. These various high-level barriers that companies need to go ahead and adhere to, but if they're only going to go to the bare minimum, that's going to make them suffer. And that's the thing where if the industry's not completely regulated yet, those are the barriers that other industries already have that this industry needs to follow.
What's your take on, I believe, are you in New York? What state are you
in? I'm in West Palm Beach, Florida.
You're in Florida. Okay, so that's good. Three states. Just wanted to get your take on from what you've been hearing. New Jersey, New York, and Florida, as far as where they're going as far as the cannabis industry.
For Florida, we know we have Amendment 3 that's now being put up for the ballot in November. I mean, it looks like if you were to have people voting south of Orlando, Tampa, or Daytona Beach, 75% easily would go ahead and vote in favor of adult-use cannabis. But that's going to be a different story of what it's going to be up north of what's the I-4 corridor. But this year, I think things are going to happen where, you know, I haven't seen a whole lot of pushback. You know, there's only so much money that's coming out now from a PAC that's going to be put together to go against the talk of cannabis as an amendment. But the thing is, abortion now is an amendment issue as this year as well. That's going to trump and supersede anything that's going on with cannabis. So cannabis is going to go ahead and be under the radar in some ways where it's going to probably going to be allowed. For New York, you know, Governor Hochul's already talked about the control board there, the Office of Cannabis Management, has to go and be rehauled. The social equity system's a bit flawed. They've had a lot of issues with licensing issues, trying to get those licenses off the ground. And for New Jersey, it looks like they're getting off to a better start.
I would say that's the case, since that's my basis in New Jersey, New York. But yes, but I think there are some things that could be done better. What are you hearing as far as people exiting the cannabis space, trying to sell their companies or merging to another company? What's the buzz on that?
Well, I think there's a lot of consolidation. I mean, I just saw that recently Cannabis is now going to be unloading in Florida here. So, you know, former Columbia Care, who's going to be coming up next? Who's going to be going to the space next and going to acquire that company? But there's a lot of acquisitions now, right? It's MSOs are going to come into the space. And I always knew it was going to happen. I mean, going back to 2016, you know, when I went to a NCIA Cannabis Business Summit, and I could see the corporations and I could see the Fortune 500 types circling around. And they were going to get ready to go ahead and come into the space, corporatize the system, you know, put it into, we could run this like any other business, and they go on. And you know what? If you want to put a corporate aspect into it, might not do well. A lot of companies have come in and, you know, they've come and gone away. But, you know, it's a matter of who's going to be able to just thrive and play along with the system, knowing they have to go and cultivate in separate states. They can't do interstate commerce yet. They have to, you know, play the long game. And those are the companies that are going to do well right now, because there's only so much you can do short term. And, you know, just in the last 5 years, the fact we had the pandemic, even though cannabis companies were essential, still, who were those who were able to go ahead and able to thrive, survive through all that mess? Now, in terms of a recessionary period, it's this problem where, you know, I mean, even if you feel just like companies willing to go out, it's a matter of there's, you know, who's still in business right now and who can still stay in business in cannabis.
So you have the benefit of having done this for a while and gone through the history and, you know, the evolution of the industry. I'm going to ask a question that's never asked before of anyone, but I think it's good for you. So if you go back, say, the beginning, 10 years ago, and where you stand right now, fill in the blanks. I was so wrong about this. I thought this was going to happen. Or I was so right about this. It did happen. What would those fill in the blanks be for both of those? In other words, going back in the history, looking now, what surprised you and what kind of you knew all along it was going to happen? And that's a pretty broad topic. So.
And I knew corporations were going to come in, and much like other businesses, they were going to go ahead and take over. So the heritage, the pioneers of the space were going to take a backseat. I felt like it was going to happen. And I also think that the messaging and marketing is being done for cannabis. In some cases, some of the mainstream larger types, they want to still stick to the stigma. They want to still stick to that narrative of, you know, it's all green leaf. It's all get stoned. It's all, you know, I don't want to use the other narratives that are out there. You know, if I say something with madness next to it, I don't even say it. It's almost like a bad word to me. But I feel like some companies feel like, well, that's what they think the space is. They still think it is today when it's not. On the business side, it's not.
Is there anything that is a surprise to you and what you did not expect to happen back 10 years ago now that you're living through it? On anything related to deployment?
I think the happy talk, the wishful thinking of those that are, well, they always like to say it's like cautiously optimistic. That was always the word I've always heard about with the industry, that everyone has to go ahead and talk happy talk. Oh, we're going to get legalized. Oh, we're going to be able to do everything else. And we're going to be, you know, all over the place in no time. And I think that's the part that is surprising, that how many people are kind of, it's, I don't want to say delusional, but I think they're just, you got to just read in a little bit more of reality and just say, it's not going to happen as quick as you think it's going to.
Yeah. Reality sets in the picture.
I mean, I don't want to go ahead and put down anybody that wants to feel that way. I mean, you're welcome to have it. But, you know, there's not a lobbying money to go into the policymakers. You know, when you're with the help of tobacco and alcohol, there might be $40 billion being put into lobbying to those policymakers who are the arbiters that will be able to go ahead and get the laws passed. We already know there's, you know, a dozen bills that have already been written and ready to go ahead and be put to the vote. Well, and they've gone through committee. Oh, they've been passed through committee. They've gone through this. Okay, but then where's the vote? You got to get these people paid to go and do it. Let's just talk the systems the way it is. If Big Pharma can spend $200 billion easily on, you know, making sure to go ahead and stop, you know, the passage of cannabis legalization, well, and where's the money coming from? You know, everybody else is worrying about their investments, but the other problem is that I'm surprised by the amount of squandering of investments that are out there.
Yeah.
There are quite a few companies that have come and gone that, you know, there was a lot of squandering, a lot of misappropriation, and a lot of no accountability for money that's being put out in seed funding. And companies are just realizing, oh, you know, these investors are getting, you know, handed nothing for their investment. No return.
I have one last question for you, George, before we kind of wrap up. So what do you think post rescheduling looks like for the cannabis industry? Do you have any opinion? So we get rescheduled from, we go from 1 to 3. What does the world look like in the cannabis industry?
Well, we've talked about it extensively on Blunt Business, the grassroots marketing. We know the 280E aspect is going to be no longer a factor.
Right.
So, you know, you see us in wellness. They want to go ahead and try to reclaim $10 million of their past taxes being put towards the federal government. Of course, the IRS is not going to go ahead and give that money back to them. They have to go to court about it. They could do that too. But at least they can go ahead and start taking, that's a good, what, you know, 10 to 12% of revenue that comes back to the companies. Are they going to reinvest? Are they going to put it towards more employees? Are they going to put it towards, you know, improving their technology or upgrading their technology, whatever there is? That's the important part. The other part is research, medical research, to continue to go ahead and legitimize the industry and to push back on any narratives that say, well, cannabis is not good for you. It's, you know, look at what they're doing to kids. Throw that all away. And finally, just go ahead and get all the research possible, because now you can go ahead and grow plants for research, and you could do more to that. You know, they're not going to get to where we're going to have the expensive pharmacies or anything like that, but at least we have those couple of caveats that come with it. I appreciate the fact we got that in the first place.
Brilliant. It's good. It's good. So, George, if people want to follow you or get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
CannabisRadio.com. We also have an app that has all of our programming there. And like I said, I host Blunt Business and Grassroots Marketing. Blunt Business drops every Wednesday. And coming up on 400 episodes doing that show, and oh my God, like 700 episodes of Grassroots Marketing we've done here since day one. You know, that's where you'll hear me and the voice. And really, just if they want to go follow along, we have all of our socials. We're Instagram, The Cannabis Radio. You can find us on LinkedIn. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter or X. That's going to do for Blunt Business. Thanks for listening in. We'll talk to you next time.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.